You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Nearly 3 months ago, the death of a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman in the custody of Iran's morality police ignited massive protests. Since Mahsa Amini's death, the protests led by women and the country's youth have plunged the country into political turmoil. The Iranian government confirms at least 300 Iranians have been killed in the nationwide protests so far, but human rights groups believe that number is far higher. According to the United Nations, at least 14,000 have been detained, including children. Coupled with the government taking an even more drastic step, approving the option of a death penalty as a sentence. The turmoil also spilled onto the global stage as the World Cup in Qatar. Dr. Sahar Rezavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State and joins us with more about the latest developments and how the Iranian community in California is responding. Professor Rezavi, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Great to be here.
You joined us almost 2 weeks ago following Mahsa Amini's death. Now we're talking as we're approaching 3 months of deadly unrest. Did you envision these global protests, which really have just spanned countries across the world, carrying to the end of the year and even potentially into the new year?
I didn't exactly anticipate that they were going to last this long and be this sustained, only probably because of my own cynicism and knowledge of how repressive and violent the responses by the government have been in the past. So I'm incredibly heartened to see that people continue to be on the streets in Iran and express their solidarity outside of Iran. But I admit it is lasting longer than I had initially thought it might.
And the developments, you know, sometimes are daily or throughout the day. If you just go online, I mean, it encompasses global events as well. And we can get into the World Cup in just a few moments. But have you had moments, given that, you know, your understandable cynicism because of historically what has happened, have you had moments where you kind of slow the clock and you begin to process everything that's unfolding into a larger context for Iran and Iranian Americans?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Iranians have been in this position before. They have a long history of dissenting against the government across successive regimes. There's a long history of opposition. So when you stop and you reflect and you kind of contextualize this in the broader history of Iranian social movements, you see that it's very clear that they know what to do. They know what needs to be done if they are going to get their demands met. It's just a matter of really being able to do them. And of course, there are obstacles for all kinds of reasons, but it's not a surprise that they are as tenacious as they are and as courageous as they are, given that they are very aware of all of the political developments that have been shaping their lives in the last 100 years.
For the Iranian diaspora here, I mean, there is strong solidarity, but also from conversations that I've had, there's also these conflicting emotions for a culture that they love, coupled with a tremendous amount of anguish of what's happening. You are the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State. How has your center been a place of support, even if it's informal?
Yeah, so we have been trying to bring together some voices from different communities across campus. A lot of people have expressed their desire to support the movement. There are some campus kind of protests that happen either here at Sac State or at Davis that we are trying to be involved with. At this point, it has been mostly a place where people come to get information and to connect with other people who are also in the same position that they are, which is, as you said, this great anguish in watching what's happening, feeling like they are too far away to do anything directly supportive, and really quite interested, I don't want to say desperate, that's probably overstating it, but extremely concerned to try to lend their support in some way that's more effective than just a hashtag online. Not that that's not important, but people want to do more than that.
Would you say that there's an overall consensus or an agreement about what's happening, or are there also maybe some disagreements about the protests?
I've seen disagreements certainly out in the world and online on the internet. Of course, all disagreements can be found.
That's online. Easy to find.
Right, exactly. But on campus, I have to say the overwhelming consensus is support for the protests, criticism of the government, not only its response to these protests, but its role in society in the last 43 years. And so I haven't really seen a lot of support for the government in the campus community or the broader Sacramento community. There has been overwhelming support for the protesters.
How has this shaped how you teach in the classroom this semester?
Students have questions. I feel always an obligation to update people to the extent that they want to be updated in my classes. This semester, I'm teaching comparative politics, so there are certainly places that this discussion is vital. At the same time, next semester, I'm teaching Mideast politics at the grad and undergrad levels both, so we're going to have a whole unit on this in both classes. I think right now, the way that I'm teaching, the way I'm approaching the actual teaching of the subject is to try to give updates, give information, provide context, provide an overall framework for understanding the social movements that we're seeing. At the same time, you have to be kind of sensitive to what people are experiencing, because even if they are not Iranian students, many of them are intimately connected to the Iranian community. And it's a very sensitive and raw time for people right now, psychologically and emotionally. So yeah. You have to be cognizant of what people's responses are going to be overall.
Yeah, it is quickly evolving and taking shape and far from over. You know, when talking about how you teach comparative politics, you know, recently you were part of an event discussing local and transnational activism of Iranian women. Are you satisfied with the coverage that you've been seeing?
Overall, the short answer is not exactly. There's a tendency in reporting on Iran in the United States, especially, to just leave out large chunks of historical context that are important to understand what's happening. And there's also a tendency to kind of flatten Iranian society. So here in the U.S., we are less likely to see a huge distance between the people and the government, generally. In Iran, however, the kind of social and cultural norm is that people accept that there is sometimes that the government doesn't represent the people, not just in a political way, but even in a strictly demographic way. And so here there's a lot of reporting on Iranians as if they are Iran, the government. And there's a lot of reporting on Iran, the government, the state, as if it is Iranian people. So I wish that reporting would be a little bit more nuanced in that way and provide a little bit more historical information.
Right, because it's been over four decades since even the Iranian Revolution back in 1979. And as I led with, a lot of these protests are being fueled by women, but also by youth.
Absolutely.
So many of them were not alive during this time. In what ways do you see that revolution from over 40 years ago influencing what's happening today?
The 1979 revolution was a broad-based, grassroots, just a momentous kind of event. And right now we look back and we call it an Islamic revolution, but at the time it was a movement for democracy. And a lot of people now feel disillusioned with what they got after that revolution. The people who are in the streets now, as you said, they weren't alive at the time. Many of them are under the age of 20. This is one of the reasons that we see so many detentions, and even several of the death sentences are for minors. However, they all have family members. They all have friends. They all have this broader historical memory about the violence that ensued in the process of the revolution and the consolidation of power by the clergy after the revolution. And so their disenchantment, their discontent, the kind of anguish of broken promises that maybe many of them never really believed were going to be fulfilled in the first place, but were beholden to try to carry through because they didn't have much individual power in the broader system. That anger is there. The pain and the trauma of the violence in the immediate years following 1979 is there. Mm-hmm. And I think, besides being very politically aware, they are also extremely really fueled by the pain of what has happened to their families and their societies. They all have cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents who were who fought in the revolution, who maybe were executed by the regime. Revolutions generally have maybe 3-7% public participation, the successful revolutions. Iran's was 11%, mm-hmm. which I know doesn't sound like a lot to a lot of people, but within the literature, it's the highest we know in recorded modern history. So all of that is there. All of that political and social awareness is there driving people.
Do you think that also fuels, because 11% is significant, and it's not like, you know, you have to personally experience a revolution, but you also can experience it through prior generations and your ancestors, your parents and your grandparents and family members who went through this or suffered extreme loss. Do you think that explains, you know, the Iranian government's also extreme and violent response, even approving the option of a sentence of death penalty for protesters, you know, many of whom are youth children?
Yes, I do. I think that the clergy, they knew that they weren't the only game in town. They knew they weren't the only option. They were one of several different major groups that were competing for power in the wake of the departure of the Shah, or the ousting of the last king of Iran. And so, at that time, there were a lot of maneuverings to get them to where they are now, and they know that that position is not solid. And so their goal, anytime there's a challenge to a state, any state, their options are to either, they have to adapt in some way. That adaptation can either be to yield a little bit in order to take some of the steam out or pacify the dissenters, the opposition, or to crack down harder. And the clergy has over and over and over again crack down harder. And I think that's what they're doing now, too, because they've seen that it's worked for them in the past. But I don't think that it's working this time. They are hoping, they just sentenced five more to death yesterday for the killing of a Basij paramilitary member. And several of the people who are currently under death sentence are minors, 16 and 17 years old. I think the total that, as far to my knowledge, is 11 at this point, total. So a couple of those are 16 and 17 years old. And they're hoping this is going to raise the barriers to participation for the people in the streets. But it doesn't seem to be slowing people down. This week, there was a three-day strike.
And that begins today, I believe, that already started
earlier this week? Yeah.
And what does that strike look like? What does the strike in response to these protests look like across Iran?
So when the strike was called, it had been building for a little while, and then when it began, the shops closed down, the bazaars closed down in Isfahan and Tehran, some of the major cities, the capital city especially, some of the major hubs of commerce. Mm-hmm. In the urban centers, shut down, as well as even some of the peripheral areas. And what that really is doing is it's creating a broad-based solidarity. Usually the merchant class is not populated by 20-year-olds, right? The people in the streets and the merchant class who are closing their shops and their banks and their grocery stores and whatever else, they're not the same people. So to me, what this indicates is a growing of this movement across different generations and different sectors of society, which doesn't bode well for the regime.
And I would imagine across Iran and provinces, you know, there are political differences and there are more conservative areas of Iran.
Sure.
But now we're starting to see protests move into these more conservative provinces. Do you think it's, those residents kind of coming around, or do you think that they are finding the courage to actually express their views and show solidarity and show support for what's happening? Or is it more complicated than that?
I think it actually is a little bit more complicated than that. It depends on which area we're talking about. So some areas like Sistan-Baluchistan province, which shares a border with, there's a Pakistani-Baluchistan, there's an Iranian Sistan-Baluchistan. Those areas have long been marginalized by the regime, and Baluchis are an ethnic minority that have been marginalized historically and subject to greater repression by the regime. So now we're seeing, in the last month and a half, we're seeing protests and also violent crackdown in that province. And it's not because they are necessarily coming around, but because their grievances are now shared in a more meaningful way, shared grievances with the rest, rather than the protest movements that Sistan-Baluchistan has seen in the past, which are more about their treatment by the government. Mm. So I think that these different sectors, different provinces, areas being pulled in, each of them has maybe a slightly different kind of reason for it.
Yeah, as with most things, right? You know, it's very nuanced and there's a lot of gray area, and it's not, it's easy to simplify, but you're doing an injustice by simplifying it because it's way more nuanced than that. When you mentioned, you know, there's the option to yield, there's been some reports recently about, you know, high-ranking government officials talking about disbanding the morality police, right, or disbanding or revising or removing the hijab law that was being reviewed. Both go back to Mahsa Amini, who died in Iranian morality police custody over not allegedly not wearing a head covering properly. But both of these reports are being downplayed, even disputed. What are you hearing? I mean, do you think there's any truth within these reports?
Yeah, so I think when I first heard the news, I was really surprised. And my initial reaction was, even if this is true, it doesn't meaningfully change the political landscape because mandatory hijab would still be the law. And the morality police were established in 2005 by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Prior to that, we have had other groups, other governmental bodies that were responsible for policing hijab in public. In the 90s, in the 80s, it was called Comité. The Basij has done it. So even if that were true, it doesn't really represent a letting up or a yielding. However, because of my surprise, I went and I looked into what Montazeri actually said. And what he said was extremely ambiguous. To me, it sounded like he used the word ta'til, which can mean it can mean disbanding. It can also mean suspending. And even more so than that, it seems as if he was just kind of trying to get out from under the accountability for what the morality police and the broader kind of spectrum of security forces have been up to in Iran. So he said that, you know, the judiciary, which he is, that's who he represents. The judiciary is not responsible for the morality police, who they would be disbanded. He said they have been disbanded by, if we take Tatil as disbanded, that they've been disbanded by the same place that they originated from. But it's not, no other governmental body has confirmed that it's being abolished. And in fact, just yesterday, a representative in parliament said that in 2 weeks, a new form of hijab is going to be introduced in parliament, in Majlis. And there's my sense from that announcement was that it was going to be a stricter form of hijab. I guess it's possible that it might be a less strict form. But to me, it doesn't really look like anybody is yielding in the realm of hijab. I think that these reports kind of caught like wildfire that it was going to be abolished. But I'm not convinced that that's what's happening. And I don't think that the government really knows exactly what to do either at this point.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Professor Sahar Rezavi, director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State, about the ongoing protests in Iran. You know, when it comes to the international community, the European Union announced more sanctions against government officials, condemning Tehran's use of force against protesters. I mean, Iran is no stranger to international sanctions as well as condemnation. But is there anything, do you have faith or optimism that the international community could actually have some weight in persuading the regime to meet some of the protesters' demands?
Yes and no. I think the international pressure matters. I absolutely think that international institutions and even norms do matter. I also think that the geopolitics of the international stage are kind of a necessary component as well to line up right now. So Iran, Russia, China, these are kind of the big bads in U.S. foreign policy, right? At least in U.S. discourse. Iran and Russia and Syria are also strongly tied. They're strongly allied. If the United States and the broader international community were able to get any one of those three, it would weaken the others. So I think that right now it behooves the international community to pressure Iran to change what it's doing on the ground. At the same time, if Iran doesn't want to yield in that way, if they can't be persuaded through these sanctions, through the calls to remove them from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women, if those kinds of measures aren't effective, I think there are also some more kind of realpolitik, traditional political measures that might be taken.
Given that Iran is also an influential country in the broader region, in the Middle East, are you seeing or do you think there'll be a broader impact of what these protests and also Iran's response to the protests, what they're having on surrounding countries in the Middle East?
Definitely. Historically, we know that revolutions tend to cluster together geographically and temporally. Typically, what people see on one side of a border happening on the other side influences them, because there are similarities. They're not the same, certainly, but there are similarities with respect to culture, religion, institutions, political processes, social formations. When these protests began, a couple of weeks after they began, I saw a video of a group of women in Kabul in Afghanistan saying they were protesting. They had signs. It was a small group, but they had signs, and their chants were along the lines of, "Our sisters in Iran can protest, so can we." So I think that it's just one small indication that anytime historically we've seen this happen over and over again. Anytime there is a huge convulsion in one society across the border or in the broader region, there are downstream impacts. And that region generally struggles with democracy building of durable institutions for various reasons. And I think that if they see this protest and the government response, if they see this unfold in a way that works to the benefit of the people, it's likely that somewhere else in the region is going to have a similar kind of experience.
And global awareness continues. I mean, just going back to the World Cup in Qatar, the national soccer team remained silent during the national anthem before their opening match. And I believe their next match, they half-heartedly sang after receiving some pressure and some criticism from government officials. Do you think the World Cup brought more attention to what's happening to Iran, and that it actually will have weight beyond the World Cup, beyond sports?
I do think that it brought attention. The World Cup is, as you know, just a massive global event. I don't know if it's going to have an impact beyond that at this point. I mean, the world of athletics, the world of soccer, it's an important one. And we have seen some major public figures like Ali Karimi, who is a kind of soccer star hero in Iran. He actually lives outside of Iran now because of his political speech inside of Iran, making the situation dangerous for him. There are impacts for sure, but I don't know that there is going to be a lot of ripples. There are going to be a lot of ripples outside of the soccer world now that the national team has been eliminated. I do think it was one arena that it was effective to bring attention to Iran. I don't think that now that they've been eliminated, attention is going to stop. I think that people who were already paying attention to what's happening there are still going to pay attention to what's happening there.
And just this morning, Time magazine, you know, they have their Person of the Year and Heroes
of
the Year.
I saw that.
They named the women of Iran Heroes of the Year. What does that signify for you?
I was very moved by it. I think one thing is to call attention to what's happening, right? The people in Iran over and over again are asking us, Moro Tanha Nazari, don't leave us alone here. Don't abandon us. They want us to amplify their voices. They want people to have their eyes on what's happening. And I think Time magazine doing that is honoring that request in substance and in form. I hope, cautiously, I hope that it represents a greater awareness and a greater centering on the voices of the people who are in Iran fighting every day for their liberation. Because I think that sometimes we get a lot of signal and noise from other places, and we sort of, we end up kind of forgetting that the people really at stake here are the ones who live there, who have to live every single day with the consequences of what's happening.
Dr. Razavi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professor Sahar Razavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State, discussing the very latest on the protests in Iran. Still ahead, the city of Sacramento provides an update on its African American Experience Project and shares more details of the first historical analysis of the city's rich Black history. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.